Rocking chair sessions. With Elisa Di Battista, Maria Teresa Barber.
Hello, everyone.
And welcome to RCS Rocking Chair Sessions, Volume 103, with artist Pamela Palma. Welcome.
Thank you.
We're so excited to have you here, fellow Bakehouse alumnus. Want to get started. Where do you want to start today, Maria?
I want to go back a little bit to the time when you were at the Bakehouse here, because that's how we met, right?
Right.
And I don't know, how many years were you at the Bakehouse?
I was here 4 years.
I think you were here before I got here.
Yes,
And you left maybe a year ago, right? Mm-hmm. And I think we first got talking about the weavings, really. Like, you know, like we were in the fiber group together when you first started it.
Yes.
Like at the very first...
That was 2016.
And do you want to talk a little bit about your time here and about the group that you started here?
So I came in 2013 and I was very excited to come because I was working from home, and if you've ever worked from home, you know that after a while the isolation gets to just be too much, and you're making art and you look at it and you're like, is this any good? Like, how do I know? It's just me. So either it's great because I did it or it's terrible because I did it. And so then when you come to a place like the Bakehouse and you have colleagues and people who have like another sense about art, you can ask questions and get input and
just totally
take a break from your own work and walk around and just see what other people are doing and just get juiced up so that you can go back in and do your own thing. Not that you're copying what they're doing, of course, but just that it's very inspirational to be in a situation where there's so many really talented artists.
Mm-hmm. So true.
Yeah. I remember Kyoko was also here, our Japanese friend, who did a lot with fiber.
Yes.
And then who else was? I think the three of us, we were from the Bakehouse, and then Aurora Molina.
Aurora came.
Mm-hmm. And can you tell us a little bit about the group that you started?
Okay, so the group is called Fantastic Fibers Miami, and you helped me come up with that name.
Right? Yeah, I think that was me.
We're brainstorming all these different names, and so that one stuck, so we picked that one. And I started it because years and years and years ago, when I moved to Miami in the 90s, there was a fiber guild in South Florida, and it was really nice, and I went to the meetings, and there were a lot of people, and they did all different kinds of fiber. It wasn't just one thing. And all over the country and all over the world, there's fiber guilds in every city, every town, every place, except once you get south of Palm Beach, we don't have any in Florida.
Wow.
And so I waited all these years for somebody to start one, and nobody did. So I did.
That's so great.
So I just, one day I put it out on social media, I'm starting a fiber group, and anybody who's interested can come to my studio on a certain day at a certain time. And like 20 people came. I was astounded because I didn't really know what kind of a response I was going to get. I knew that there were a lot of fiber people working in different places around Miami. So that was how it got started. And so over the 3 years, it's gone through a lot of different permutations. And now I don't have a studio, so now we either meet at, we travel sometimes to different museums. If there's an exhibition that's relevant, we'll go there. We went to the Murakami Museum to see a Shibori and Indigo exhibit. It was fabulous. It was way worth the drive. It was a long drive, but it was so worth it. And we had lunch. They have a wonderful restaurant. So we went to MoCA one day. They had an exhibit that was relevant. And next month, there's one opening at the Bath, Sheila Hicks. So I'm very excited about that. She's like the mother of fiber art from back in the 70s.
Nice.
And when we aren't traveling from museum to museum, then we meet right down the street from here at Pandori Cafe.
Mm-hmm.
The little French. Yeah, because, you know, they have parking and
they do.
The food is good and it's casual and we can hang out and they don't care how long we sit at their table. So.
We're also building the community here, just
yeah.
And it was fun because at the very beginning we also met at this where the church was, right?
Mm-hmm.
Aurora had her studio there before she
downtown.
Came to the big house.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, I don't remember what it was called, but it was like the church and then
that old church downtown. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think they got rid of all the art studios and I don't know if they tore it down or
know.
What
I
they
hope
did.
Because the actual sanctuary was so beautiful. Mm-hmm. It was like the Gussman Theater downtown was like mm-hmm. from that same era with that same kind of all that.
Like the deco.
Beautiful
yeah.
building, beautiful
oh,
building.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was really interesting. But I remember that first meeting when all of a sudden we had like Pamela's studio was not small, but you also had two big looms in there,
right.
Or at least one big loom, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we were like 20 people sitting in Pamela's studio.
In. Yeah.
But what I remember what we really did, what you did, was the knit day
yes,
at the PAM.
The knit in
which
public
was like
day.
Awesome.
Oh,
yes,
talk about
we did
that. Yeah.
three times. So it's called Worldwide Knit in Public Day, and it was started by some woman in Denmark who she likes to knit, and she said, you know, back in the day, people would knit wherever they went,
mm-hmm.
and it would be not uncommon to be sitting on a park bench with your friends, and everybody would be knitting, men, women, everybody. And she said, now it's gotten so that it's like an isolation thing. You sit at home and you knit, in front of TV or whatever. And she wanted to bring it back out into the public because it is really, and especially in northern climates.
It's cold all the time.
Yeah, yeah, so knitting keeps you warm twice, once while it's on your lap while you're working on it, and then you get to wear the thing, or it's a blanket, and you get to wear it. So she started this thing called Worldwide Knit in Public Day, and it's always the second Saturday of June, which is a horrible time for us in Miami, but in Denmark, it's probably the best day of the year.
Can't do it any other month.
I mean, it's always warm here anyway, so.
So
no,
really,
I mean, knitting in June in Miami outside.
At PAM was incredibly horrible.
Not a good idea.
Yeah, we were dying. We were absolutely dying. So
on the steps outside,
yeah.
I mean, overviewing the water and everything was beautiful. But it was so hot.
It was so hot. But a lot of people came
mm-hmm.
anyway. So, and the nice thing about that is that it's a community thing, but it's international. So while you're sitting on the porch sweating to death,
they're doing it worldwide.
They're doing it worldwide, so you're connected. You know, it's like this invisible thread of connectivity that's all over. And I just think that's a beautiful thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they have a website, so people can look up Worldwide Knit in Public Day. We'll probably do it again. I don't know where. Last year we did it at Aventura Mall, and a lot of people didn't pay any attention. Other people were like, what are you doing? So that was kind of fun. And then we did it twice at PAM. The first year we were outside, and the second year they said, oh, you can come inside. I'm like, oh, thank you.
So in the learning theater?
Yeah, we're in the theater.
Right, yeah.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so that was much better. Yeah.
I mean,
mm-hmm. I only went to the one outside, but funny enough, I don't meet a lot of Austrians here in Miami.
That's right.
But I met my Austrian friend Verena at the Knit in Public Day.
That's right.
Which was so nice.
Yeah,
yeah.
And she's an avid knitter.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was great.
So Fantastic Fibers Miami has a website, so you can look it up and you can stay, you know, kind of
in
abreast
contact.
Of yeah,
yes.
what's going on. And also I post on Facebook and Instagram when we have meetings or anything. And we have projects we do, like group projects and individual mm-hmm. projects. Just like we have a quilt project that we're doing now, we don't have to, but if you want to participate, you have to make a 9-inch square, which isn't very big.
Okay, 9x9.
Only using two colors.
Okay.
So it's a design challenge because if you want to use a print fabric, it can only have two colors in it. And otherwise, if you use solids, like it can only be those two colors, and you can cut them up into any kind of configuration and make just a little square.
Nine,
so that's
nine.
Something I don't usually do quilting, so this is like a challenge for me.
quilting bees where you have to gather and somebody's holding like the top layer, somebody's helping hold on the stuffing.
Yeah, no,
in the
we're
middle.
Not doing that. We're just each doing 1 9-inch square and there's only a few of us, so when we get done we've got this 9-inch square. I don't know what we'll do with them then, but that's beside the point. The point is just to challenge your brain to think creatively, and it's, you know, geometry and proportions and color harmony and all of that.
A little bit different.
Yeah.
I remember we did this project that I still have here. We were supposed to donate it. We were knitting, remember?
Mm-hmm.
We were knitting these blankets, and I think we donated them to the Lotus House.
Mm-hmm.
And I could not part, and my donation is still
because you had the most exquisite yarn. That's why. You bought like $1,000 a pound yarn.
I know. I went all out. And I think, yeah, I remember that. And then I had it finished, and I was like, I just hang on.
You gifted it to yourself.
I still have it.
It got you knitting, though.
No, I remember because it was also, we were supposed to use your yarn that is washable, right?
That's true.
And I think I was just very way off with the yarn that I got, but it was fun. It was fun. You got me knitting, yeah.
Right, because it was for the families that live at Lotus House.
Yeah, and for the babies. So you needed it to be, like, washable.
Right.
And, like,
yeah, I don't think the one you have is washable.
No.
It feels really nice.
Yeah.
You mentioned something about arriving, was it the 90s when you moved to Miami?
Yes.
Why Miami?
Why not? I lived in Buffalo. Oh, my God. Buffalo was a great place to raise my daughter, and we lived there for like 13 years, and then one day she had already moved down here. She finished school and she was down here, and she's like, "Mom, why are you still in Buffalo?" I'm like, "That's a really good question."
So your daughter got you to move down here.
Yeah, I mean, I'd been down here. My mom was a snowbird, so we used to come down for spring break and stuff, but she was in Broward, so it wasn't quite the same. But we came down here, and we're like, you know, nothing was really happening yet, but it was like starting. You could feel like the momentum was building, and all these people were coming, and it was very exciting. Lincoln Road was totally derelict. There were homeless people sleeping in every doorway. Mm-hmm. The Art Center had about 8 buildings.
Totally.
With all different things going on in them, and just there was just like an excitement, and I was ready for some excitement.
Mm-hmm.
Buffalo is a lovely place to live and raise your family, but it's not exciting.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, Buffalo.
I know, sorry, Buffalo. My family won't want to hear this.
Well, maybe it wasn't exciting for you. Everybody's different.
That's true.
Yeah, there you go.
That's true.
You were like looking for something different, right?
Yes, it's like, I was looking for something different. Because I know people tell me that, you know, that they love it, they have fun, and I had fun. I made it work for me. That's wherever you go, you have to make it work for you.
What do you do in Buffalo?
When it's not snowing?
Like it's snowing. Can you go skiing there?
Yeah, you can go skiing.
Oh, that's what I would do probably.
Yeah. I learned how to ski just so that I could get through the winters, and there's ice skating and tobogganing and all that kind of stuff. I also spent a lot of time antiquing on the weekends with my cousin. We'd go out to like all these places out in the country where the roads were clear, and I collected up 1,000 doilies, crocheted beautiful antique doilies and different textile things mostly. So, I mean, there's things to do. I had an art studio, so I was busy.
Oh, you did already in Buffalo?
I started my art studio there. So it was, you know, full speed ahead. I was designing clothing and the fabric to make the clothing. So then we had fashion shows and art exhibits, and, you know, I was hooked in with the art community there. So it was busy, and it was good, but it's winter there a lot, and I'm not really a winter person.
Yeah, I know.
So you have to be a winter person.
Austria is probably similar to Buffalo in that way.
Yes.
Yeah.
You mentioned the clothing, which I think is a whole, it's a different side of your fiber practice, because I do feel that you do the weavings and you do knit, but you also do clothing and fashion. Can you tell us how you got into that?
So I started working with textiles when I was really, really young. My mother sewed and she knitted, and my grandmother sewed and she knitted and crocheted and embroidered, and I was fascinated, and I would watch them and I was like, show me. And they didn't want to teach me how to knit because I was like 4. No, she'll poke her eye out. I'm like, no, I won't. Don't ever tell me no, you can't do something. So my grandmother taught me how to do it, and my mom helped me, and I learned how to knit. And so I was making clothes for my dolls because I was 4.
Fine.
Right? So I remember the first thing I made, it was a little scarf for my doll, and I didn't really know what I was doing, and it started out like a couple inches wide, and it got wider and wider and wider and wider. I don't know what I did, but I loved it. I just thought it was the greatest thing. Yeah. So, and then my grandmother showed me how to sew by hand, just with a needle and thread. And I was looking at my doll one day, and I was looking at, like, doll clothes, and I said, oh, it would be so easy to make a pair of pants. All you have to do is cut a W and sew up the sides and sew up the V part, and you've got pants, right? So I made some. I still have them. I made this pair of pants for my doll. Of course, I didn't really understand all about curves and fitting and everything like that, but still, I mean, I was a little kid, and I was designing and sewing.
That's incredible.
So, thanks. And so it just, like, my desire for things that were different and things that were handmade, I saw a lot of value in things that were handmade because it was in my family. And my mom made really cool clothes for me when I was little. And then in school, we had to take home ec. Do you remember home ec?
Yeah, I should have taken that instead of...
I had home ec.
I took physics. What a mistake.
Anyways, no cooking. I didn't have to cook, but all the rest. We did sewing
and knitting. And they cooked in ours. I missed out.
Yeah. So I didn't like the cooking part. We had to do both cooking and sewing. But I loved sewing because they showed us how to work with commercial patterns.
Cool.
And so once I figured that out, I was like, oh, I'm off and running. And so then I started just making all my own clothes because I don't like looking like everybody else. I never did. I know that's really odd. Usually when you're in junior high age, you want to look just like everybody else. Mm-hmm. But I was like, I like that outfit, but I would like it better if it was like this. And so I would go to the store and buy the pattern and buy the fabric and make it. And so throughout my life, I was sewing and making clothes. Then at one point, I decided to go back to school and finally finish, because I had never finished my degree, and take fashion and textile course.
Nice.
So the fashion part was I just wanted to get better at designing clothes and learn little techniques of tailoring and all of that, pattern making, all those subtle nuances of fashion design. And the fabric part, I would learn how to print fabric. I'd be able to print my own yardage with, like, wild, crazy, and it was the 80s, so anything goes. And it was so much fun. So part of that also just segued. We were supposed to, it was a requirement for the degree, was we had to take this fiber course, which was weaving. Mm. And I didn't want to weave. I had been avoiding it like the plague my entire life. People kept, like, giving me looms. No. Come sit down. I want to show you how to do this. You'd be really good at it. No. It's like, no, I'm not a weaver. So I had to take weaving. And I sat at this little tapestry loom and designed this piece and fell head over heels in love with the medium.
So
it's like fate tricked me.
That thin line between love and hate. You're like, no, it's not for me. And then you're like, oh my God, where were you?
I know, exactly. Yeah, so exactly. And so it was 1985. I have not been able to stop weaving ever since.
It's amazing.
So, because then I realized, and I was in Buffalo again, so cold, I'm weaving with, you know, nice thick fabric. I could make fabric for winter clothes. So silk screening is great for summer clothes, but where I lived, it was mostly winter, so this was awesome. Mm-hmm. So that was how I segued into weaving. And then because it was art school design program, we had to not just do yardage or just follow a pattern, but, like, how can you make it different? How can you make it yours? How can you take this idea and develop it into something with other materials besides yarn? And so I kind of went off on another tangent with the weaving, and then still with fashion, I was still doing something else with printed fabric and sewing, and I put it all together. And now it's just like, I get up in the morning, like, do I want to weave? Do I want to cut up woven fabric? Do I want to sew? Do I want to embroider?
What does the project call for?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly. And sometimes it changes midway. You have an idea and you're working on it, and then all of a sudden the project says, no, we're going to try something new.
You can't fight it sometimes.
No, you can't.
It tells you what it needs.
It does. Mm-hmm. It absolutely does.
Tell us a little bit about the show that you recently had at the Taplin Gallery. It was a solo show.
Yes.
I missed it because
I wanted
to come. And I don't know. We were doing probably something with Rocking Chair Sessions. It was a crazy month.
It was.
And, but tell us a little bit about
the body work.
That body of work that you showed. It's mm-hmm. an incredible, beautiful space.
Isn't it?
Huge.
Yeah.
Huge double story gallery, which is in the lobby of Miami Country Day School.
Curved walls.
Incredible. Yeah.
Really beautiful.
Challenging space too, but beautiful. Mm-hmm. You know? Tell us a little bit about how this show came together.
So the show came together. I had gone to see a show, Stephanie. Stephanie Jaffe, right, who was also my bakehouse buddy. She had a show the previous April, and I went, and I didn't even know this gallery existed. And I went in there, and I was like, oh my God, this space is amazing. Mm-hmm. You can put anything in there. It would just look fabulous because it's in such a nice environment.
Totally.
And so I was talking to the curator, told her a little bit about what I did, and she's like, we have never had a fiber show here. And I'm like, well.
You're welcome.
So we set it up for the opening of the season for 2018-2019. So it was in September.
Oh, that's lovely.
So that was great because this was back in April. So that gave me all the time to get everything ready. And so I have a huge body of work that I do with shredded $100 bills.
Remember.
Yes, I acquired this whole bale of $100 bills shredded by the Federal Reserve Bank. They take them out of circulation, and I was able to get them. So, yes, it's legal. No, it's not, you know.
You weren't taping them back together.
No. Well, you could try, but the numbers are recorded, and you will go to jail if you try to spend it. Plus, they're really skinny, so
can
it's
you
a
imagine?
Lot of taping.
It's so suspect. You're like, one side looks so much like normal, and the other side's like all taped up.
Why is this whole thing held together with scotch tape? So I find it's like a wonderful medium to work with because it's paper, so it has like flexibility. And it's linear, so I can stick it into the weaving and put it in there. And once I got my hands on this bale of money, I started thinking about all the ways that we use money in our vocabulary, expressions, just like it's tied in with every single thing of our lives. There's like nothing that we can do that doesn't have some connection to money. So I started doing weaving things like money can't buy me love, that was one piece, and money doesn't grow on trees, like all the obvious expressions. And then I started thinking about other things and it just segued. So I did a couple of pieces with, and I also like weaving with paper, so I took some maps of, some tourist maps from Tampa Bay. I had gone up there, I was like on vacation in Tampa. So I had these maps of Tampa Bay and I cut them up and I rearranged them and then I wove them with the shredded money. So the idea there in my mind was, what has happened because of money to the geography of Florida? Mm-hmm. Like the Bay.
Certain cities.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Everything, like even down here, I would do it here if I could find the right maps. But our bay has been filled in. We have islands that didn't exist there before. There's like all kinds of things. The currents are everything has changed, all because somebody wanted to develop the land and make money. So it's all back rooted back to money. Mm-hmm. So I decided after talking to the curator, let's just do a show that only is the pieces that I have with shredded money in it. So it turned out there were 35 pieces.
Wow.
Two of them are murals. I call them murals because they're 20 feet long.
Ginormous.
Yeah, ginormous.
Wow.
40 inches high and 20 feet long.
Oh my God.
And so those curved walls were perfect for that because they just sort of wrapped around and they were so eye-catching. So the one that was on the big wall, I call Currents Currency. And I used vintage nautical charts of Florida, the water off the shore of Florida. And it's woven in, the maps are woven in with the money and with yarn, and there's a pattern that goes through it, and it's like colorful and everything. But you have to look up close before you see what it is, and then you can see like different cities nearby or the Keys and all this stuff. So you can stand at one end of it and you'll be at St. Augustine, and you can go all the way to Key West.
Awesome.
without leaving the gallery.
Travel in time through the Taplin Gallery.
Right.
I like that.
So that was one of them. And she was just like amazed that, you know, I had this piece that was so long. We kept unrolling it and unrolling it and unrolling it. So
how did you hang it?
Well, you know, her son is the wizard of hanging. So I had rings on the back of it all along, like every 3 feet or so. So they suspended it.
Oh, you had the rings, and then you could hang it from the system.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Wow, incredible.
Yes.
It's so good.
So all the pieces had money in them, and all of them had, like, some significance with, you know, society and just kind of social commentary, but kind of humorous as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you feel that you like to involve humor in your pieces, or some kind of like joy and happiness, whether it's through the usage of material, in this case dollar bills or color?
Both. Okay. Yes, I do. I feel like with my art, that even if I do put social commentary in it, it has a little bit of like a snicker. And I try to also make the pieces be really visually appealing so that they're not an expression of angst or dismay or something. It's just kind of like, look at that.
Alluring.
That used to be Tampa Bay, but now it's like Tampa Bay doesn't look like that anymore because it's been changed. So I want it to be significant and symbolic, but at the same time be something that somebody would actually hang on the wall in their living room. Mm-hmm. You know, or hang in their bedroom and not be like, oh my God, I have to wake up to that every morning, because some art just would make you like, yeah. So yeah, I put a little bit of joy. I like to put some beauty into everything. I think people need that in their lives because the world is so chaotic and so confusing that it's nice to have something that just is like, oh yeah, makes you feel good.
Mm-hmm. Makes you feel good.
Yeah.
I'm curious. You mentioned Buffalo as a place where you lived for a long time. Is that where you were born?
It's where I was born, and so I lived there till I was 18, and then I moved out to New Mexico, and I lived there for about 10 years.
How was that impactful? And like, first of all, like color usage, but also like they have so many beautiful, deep and rich, like historical use of weaving, like with the Native Americans.
And that's when I was saying, no, I don't want to weave.
In New Mexico.
I was doing pottery. I had a pottery studio. I had a wheel and a kiln and like all that stuff. So many things can you do? And my hands were dirty because I had clay.
Pottery.
So
Wow, that's amazing.
So I used to do that. And then I got tired of not being able to have fingernails, and my hands were getting really beat up.
And dry, yeah.
Yeah, and in New Mexico, everything's dry anyway.
Totally.
And so then the clay just made it even worse. And I just said, I can't, I'm only 20, I can't destroy my hands now because I'm going to need these. These are my tools.
In the long run, they are our tools.
So I was still sewing then and doing embroidery and things like that, but I will not weave. That was my mantra. But the colors of the desert, oh my God, I loved it. I loved it. It was so subtle. But if you know, as artists, we know how to look at things and how to see beyond just like, somebody would drive across the desert and say, oh, this is so boring. And I would look at it and say, it's like barely green, but it's just this beautiful pale tint of something.
You pick up on the little tiny nuances.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, the mountains are, and the clay and everything out there is all different colors, orange and red and pink and...
Totally.
Yeah, so I was just in love with the landscape and the wide open spaces of all of that. And the cultures of the Native Americans and the Spanish people who came from way back with Coronado, and just all the mixture of all the people. And it was the 70s, so it was very different. It was really very much like a third world country because it wasn't very populated. And you could pretty much do whatever you wanted and nobody bothered you.
That's amazing. Yeah. And I imagine your studio space is probably like pretty large.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was nice.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Because I'm just wondering, when people travel and move, I feel like there's something that you pick up on in that area, something like from Buffalo to, like you said, to New Mexico, New Mexico going back to Buffalo, like how did your work change then?
Yeah. Well, yeah. How did my work change then? The first thing that I wove was the landscape from New Mexico, and I was in Buffalo.
You were missing it.
I was missing it. I was sitting on my front porch. It was Indian summer. It was one of those crisp days where the sun is out and the air is like really dry, which doesn't happen so often in humid places like Buffalo or Florida. but it was just like this gorgeous crisp September day, and I was weaving this place that I remembered from New Mexico, and
just in your feelings. Oh.
So, and I still have that weaving. It's like one of my favorite things. Wow. Yeah.
But it was also with a map, right?
No.
It was like, what was it? New Mexico? What did you say?
The landscape.
It was a landscape.
Oh, it was a landscape.
Yeah, it was a landscape. Mm-hmm. It was all yarn. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Do you collect materials? Do people donate materials? Or do you purchase materials? How does that work?
Well, you know, being artists, people are always giving us stuff, right?
Right. That sounds like curious. Yeah. Like every time you move to a new place, like do you purge or do you just take with you?
Oh, I take everything. I take everything.
You have a pretty big collection of materials.
I have a really big collection of materials. And
looms too, right?
Yeah, I have a whole like fleet of looms.
Wow.
And all different types for all different purposes and everything. And so like the shredded money, that was somebody said, we had looked at something, I had been out at a gallery with this person and there was something that had money in it, and I was like, wow, that's really cool, I would love to weave that. And she worked for the Federal Reserve Bank, she said, I'll get you some.
Amazing.
So la-ti-da, here I am, I still have some. And then now I have like a box that I keep with oddities, like weird things that could possibly go into a piece someday. And every once in a while I rummage through and I'm like, oh, I'm going to, yes, and there's an idea.
Now is the moment for this one.
Yeah.
It's always curious.
Yeah, I feel like the time you were at the Bakehouse, you've been experimenting a lot with like inserting different materials also into your weaving.
Yes.
I was like,
yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's been really fun, adding different things and making it more mixed media. Mm-hmm. And like taking off in a direction instead of just weaving with yarn. But you still have to have yarn because that's what holds it all together. Mm-hmm. And then depending if I'm doing an art piece, then I can go as wild as I want to. But if I'm doing something that's going to be wearable, then I'm looking for, and that's when I buy, mm-hmm. yarn that's really natural fibers and really lovely, you know, tactile, mm-hmm. that
feels.
You just want to feel against your skin, that's mm-hmm. delicious.
Mm-hmm. Instead of scratchy.
Yeah.
Also the towels that you all made, they were always so fascinating. They were always just the beautiful colors, like a lot of...
Oh, thank you.
Like the, like, you know, aqua, mm-hmm. a lot of aqua blue, and just like the materials, it was really, really beautiful. I remember those.
Oh, thank mm-hmm. you.
Yeah, I really love color. Mm-hmm. And so being here in Florida, you're just surrounded by gorgeous colors.
Like, pops everywhere.
Yeah, you know, I walk the dog every morning and I see something new every day. Like, oh, this tree wasn't blooming yesterday. Like, wow, what a color. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, and I'll just like stare at it and absorb that color because mm-hmm. then I'll use it someday in something. Mm-hmm. It'll come out again. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I love that for you.
What are you working on right now? Do you have any, you know, we're always trying to cover, do you have any projects coming up? And also, like, one thing was, like, how was this transition back from the Bakehouse to your, have a home studio now again,
yes,
right? How was that for me? So a lot of questions, but answer
okay.
whatever you want to.
Okay, so we'll go back to the transition. So transitioning from the Bakehouse to my home studio was, I had to downsize a lot mm-hmm. because the room that I originally had as a studio before I came to the Bakehouse is now a guest room and has a bed in it and a dresser mm-hmm. among
oh,
other things.
No.
And so I had to like figure out what could I squeeze in there. And weaving is messy. You wouldn't think so but it makes a lot of dust and a lot of lint and it takes a lot of space. Those looms are huge.
Yeah.
So I said, I'm not going to put my floor looms in my apartment, and that's the only room I could do it in because that's the only place where I have good light, and I really need good light. Mm-hmm. So, boohoo, my looms are in storage, mm-hmm. But I have portable looms that I have at home because I can put those under the bed,
nice.
out of the way when I'm not using them, and when I teach, that's what I use, and I pull them out, and we do that. But last year when I went home, the first thing I did was I had been starting to do clothing again, mm-hmm. and so I thought, well, this is the perfect time to do clothing. And I'm tired of the clothes that I see in the stores. They're either like really poorly made or they're really expensive or both.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't like them and I don't want to look like everybody else. Back to that same thing. Mm-hmm. So I just spent a lot of time sewing, and then I got a colleague here, Judy Burke King, mm-hmm. came by one day and she handed me a stack of cloth napkins. I don't need any more cloth napkins. I have about 30, maybe 50. So maybe more, because when I went antiquing, that was one of the things that we bought.
Totally, so, like cloth napkins.
But she gave me these white cloth napkins, and she said, "You like fabric, don't you?" And I'm like, "Well, yeah." So they're big. They're like, you know, 16-inch squares. And I had them one day, and I thought, I'm never going to use them for dining. What if I embroidered luncheon plates on cloth napkins? I have this collection of luncheon plates. They were my mom's. So they're bone china. They all have little floral motifs. So I started just, like, going through them and picking, like, elements of the floral motifs and embroidering them. So I thought, that's kind of a quirky thing, because I'm embroidering a luncheon plate on a cloth napkin that's never going to get used. It's just going to be an art piece. So I have 7 of them finished, maybe, and I started the 8th one the other day. Just so every once in a while I get an idea.
Like, I woke up one morning. You do a whole series of them now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I woke up the other morning and I'm like, I'm going to do a yellow one. And I pulled this yellow plate out of the cupboard and ironed up the napkin and traced out this circle and drew the, it's going to be yellow roses, and drew the flower on it and started embroidering. I'm like, where did that come from? I mean, I woke up and it just, like, hit me. So that's how inspiration works. So that's a project, and that's a nice thing because I can do that while I'm watching TV at night. It's easy.
Definitely. Mm-hmm.
Or I can take it with me if I have to go somewhere. I can,
yes.
You know, like weaving, you can't really, it's not so portable.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a project. I have a bunch of clothes started, so I'm doing my spring wardrobe.
Fun.
Yeah.
Summer's here.
It's fun. Yeah, I found this little fun fabric store out by Tropical Park.
Mm-hmm.
And got these beautiful linens and cottons and things to make mm-hmm. some really unusual fashions. So I'm like,
and you're
excited about that.
You're also still continuing to teach, right? Because you
yep.
did that at the bakehouse already.
Yes, I am. Mm-hmm. I'm still teaching. I have weaving students and sewing students and an embroidery student sometimes. So all of that. So the other project that I'm working on right now that's on the table is for an exhibition that's coming up in June.
Okay.
It's at Studio 18 in the Pines.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know that gallery?
Yeah.
I haven't been yet, Maria.
Yeah.
No, I haven't been either, but I know about them.
Okay. Yeah. So I have a show there in 2 weeks. It opens April 12th. It's called Spectrum.
Nice. Mm-hmm.
And so like that show is all about color. So I have 4 pieces that I'm putting into that show. So you have to come to that.
Yes.
Yeah, definitely.
We'll be there.
We want
yes.
to check it out.
So I put that up on social media, so you may mm-hmm. have seen it. I'm pretty sure I sent you invitations.
I got the email.
Okay, mm-hmm. good. And so after this show comes down, then the curator is doing a show just for fun for the summer, because it's by June.
I know,
who's
things
here?
Kind of
everybody,
die down.
Yeah,
everybody's selling.
So this one is toys. So it's all artist toys.
Fine.
So I'm making, this is so crazy, it inspired me to make this series of soft sculpture dolls.
Yes.
I've had the pattern since 1974. You asked me, what do I do with stuff? I bought that in New Mexico. I thought that would be a great idea. I had a little girl. I thought she would love these toys. She didn't care about them at all.
Oh, no.
So the pattern's been in the envelope for how many years? Count them. And the paper is, like, brown and brittle, but
I
took it out. They're ethnic dolls.
Cool.
So I wasn't so sure if this was, like, is this going to be, like, politically correct? Because they're all different nationalities.
I think that's kind of beautiful, though. And also, I think it's all about intentionality. I think if
yes.
you're not creating something to be, like, I don't know, offensive, or if you're not making some, if it comes from a pure place and you're
right.
doing it because you appreciate the culture and you think it's beautiful,
exactly.
and you're, you know, doing it in a respectful way, there's nothing wrong with that. It's like,
right.
I don't know, people eat Mexican food. I'm like, no, don't eat Mexican food. I'm like, no, great, celebrate my culture, enjoy
yes,
it, you know,
exactly.
whatever, I love it. So,
right.
yeah, I think it's not, I don't think it's
okay.
intentional.
Do you have an Austrian doll costume?
No,
later
but there's a
or something?
No, but that would be cool.
Yeah, I know. That's
because basically, I mean, it's a really simple shape. There's the head, and then it's just, it's not like a real form. It's just sort of a rounded triangle is the body, and then each one, there's 6 of them in the pattern, each one is embellished in a different way so that
oh,
it reflects
fun.
The costume, like the native costume. So the first one I did, and this is a stash busting project because I can rummage through all my boxes of stuff
and
use up fabrics
fits.
That I have mm-hmm. without having to go out, because why would you?
Why should you? Yeah.
Not when
no.
you're We don't call it hoarding because they're art supplies, but I need all this stuff. Collecting, mm-hmm. Exactly.
The moment you get rid of it, you know you need it. It happens to me every time.
Every time. Doesn't it? Yeah. Should I save this? Well, I almost threw the pattern away like 30 times over all these years. Like, I'm never going to do this. Yes, you are. No, you're not. Yes, you are.
I'm glad you held on to it.
I am too. Yeah. So the first one I did is Japanese.
Cool.
And she's all in silk, and she's really lovely.
Oh, that's
and
beautiful.
Now the one that I'm doing is Spanish. She could be Mexican.
That's nice.
It's hard to tell. I named her Rosita Senorita.
Nice. Her middle name. There you go.
And so I had a meltdown the other day because I couldn't find the right fabric for her dress, and I thought I had something in silk in my drawer, and I couldn't find it. And it wasn't enough, and nothing that I tried was working. And so I found this big white piece of some kind of shiny something. And I pulled out my rubber stamps, and I printed the fabric.
Why not?
And so she has a tone-on-tone white dress with white spirals on it. And then she's got a little shawl that's like a little ruffly thing that's crocheted.
Any pom-poms?
Not yet, but that's a good idea. She could have some pom-poms.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right there.
Yeah. I mean, there's nothing more Mexican than little pom-poms.
That's true. Yeah. I could put some on her wrist. Flowers. She needs something on her wrist.
Totally.
So that's what's on the table now.
Oh, that's fun.
And if I have enough...
How many nationalities are you going to do?
Well, somebody suggested I do three because then it's a collection. Uh-huh. So
yeah. I like things in threes.
Yeah,
I know.
So three is good, and hopefully he'll pick three to put it, you know, he'll take all three of them to put in the show. So, but there are six, and there's like an Eskimo, and there's a Ukrainian doll.
Oh, that's lovely.
And there's a Native American, and there's an African. And then I did the Japanese, and now I'm doing Spanish. Yeah, so that's
great. But it's also really interesting to me because it's like, okay, so you bought them in the 70s in New Mexico.
Right.
Right? It's almost like a history course also, like, of what people were considering, like, the nationalities or that they were considering at that time, right?
Right.
Because I was, like, thinking, okay, so in New Mexico in the 70s, you would do, like, a Ukrainian girl? I mean, really?
Why not? I think of, like, Walt Disney with, like, It's a Small World, right? You know, where you represented the whole planet. It's the idea of, like, this connection, this planetary connection of appreciating all cultures, which I think
is phenomenal. Yeah, but it's interesting what cultures they picked, right?
I don't know.
Well,
I
it's a Vogue pattern.
It's interesting.
It's a Vogue pattern. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I don't know where Vogue is headquartered, probably New York.
Totally.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So it's one of their craft patterns.
And I think it's also like they're selecting one from each of like one from like the Americas, like the Latin Americas, one from like the Asian, one from the, like it's a little bit, you pick
from each continent,
continent is represented.
Oh, yeah. That makes sense.
Mm-hmm. That does make sense. Uh-huh. Yeah, it's pretty neat. I'm looking forward to seeing
it. Yeah, it's cool. But it's almost like historic already.
It is.
You know, because the patterns are.
Right.
But you're interpreting the patterns, obviously, with all the choices that you make.
Yeah, because they don't look anything like, you know, people look at it and then I show them the pattern and they're like trying to make
how
the correlation.
How did you get from here to there?
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Like, well, this is the fabric I had. I didn't have what they have, so I used what I have.
So they tell you exactly what you're supposed to use?
Well, they have the shape of the doll and then they have the shape of the garments that are sewn directly onto the body of the doll. Cause she's just like a big blob.
A form.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's a form. So then there's like a mark on there where the sleeve goes. So the sleeve for the Japanese one was shaped like a kimono sleeve. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, there's like cording around the edge.
Or each one's different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and then the Spanish one, she's got like puffy sleeves with like ruffles.
Mm-hmm.
And her hair is long. And, you know, her dress is like different. So each one has like its own
specifications.
Yes.
Stuff.
And then,
that's
you know,
so interesting.
Being creative, you do whatever you want. And in the 70s, soft sculpture was a thing.
Yeah,
so
it's what I'm also talking about. It is also like a product of the time, you know, that is like how even the shape of the doll is and all of that, right? It's
right.
So interesting.
Yeah, it's not anatomically correct at all.
Mm-hmm. Because it reminds me, because the soft sculpture, I think like, it reminds me of what Louise Bourgeois did, for example, with soft sculpture,
yes,
right? And, and of course, way, way, way before already,
right,
all the dolls, right? All
yeah.
Them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So much fun.
Yeah, and so it is fun. It's creative, and I just, you know.
Where is that exhibit going to be?
That'll also be at Studio 18.
Studio 18 for the summer.
Mm-hmm. For the summer.
And so the curator is?
The curator is Michael Edelberg. Mm-hmm. Michael the Edelberg. Nicest guy in the world.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. I also wanted to ask about the project. You mentioned the Fabulous Fibers. Mm-hmm. Where do you see mm-hmm. that going?
Fantastic Fibers.
Mm-hmm. Where do you want to see that go in the next few years?
Well, what I would like to see, first of all, I would like to attract more people who work in fiber of any sort mm-hmm. to come together and to do community projects that could impact the community. Like, we did one last year at the Museum of Contemporary Art in North Miami, MoCA. And we worked with the kids in their teen program and taught them how to knit.
That's nice.
And so mm-hmm. everybody knitted these long scarf things out of scrap yarn, and then we wrapped the pillars on the outside of the building, so we yarn bombed. And so the museum was like, well, you know, they were sort of like, okay. They weren't so excited about it, but then it looked fabulous. And all these people came to take selfies in front of their museum, and they would hashtag MoCA.
Nice.
And it went out on social media. And so from a 2-week, okay, we'll let you have it up for 2 weeks, it ended up staying up for 3 months.
Amazing.
And then finally they said, we're so sorry, it has to come down, but we're painting the building.
Okay.
So that was like something, and that was an outreach from the Fiber Guild. Mm-hmm. So I would like to see other things that we can do that'll bring people together, because fiber and fabric and cloth and yarn and thread is universal. And it's something that connects everybody. I mean, we're all wearing clothes. Mm-hmm. So we're always touching fabric from the first minute that we're born. We're wrapped in a blanket right away when we come out. And then when we die, they put you in your best outfit before they put you in the casket, right? So every minute of your life, you're always in clothing. You're always touching something with fabric. And yet, people just don't even think about it half the time. They blindly go into the closet and grab something to put on. But it's a really vital part. It's important to us as breathing, but mm-hmm. We don't think about breathing either, unless you're doing yoga or something, you know?
Or you can't breathe.
Yeah, or you can't breathe. Exactly. So I just would like to make people more aware of fabric and fiber, and also as an art form. And just because it's women's work or has been women's work, it isn't always women's work. There are a lot of weavers in traditional cultures around the world that the weavers are the men.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, it's like a misnomer to put it in that.
Getting rid of that stigma. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and just to bring people together. It's like, it's a comfortable thing to work with. It feels nice. People are like relaxed when they're working with it.
Mm-hmm.
And you get to know people that you would never know otherwise. So it's just like just a community thing.
But I think mm-hmm. you're hitting a spot there with when you were talking about the dolls, but now also talking about this, you know, more of a community effort. I see in front of my inner eye, like, Elisa showing up in her Panamanian dress, you know? I'm thinking back of how I grew up and these Tyrolean outfits, the dirndls, and,
yes.
you know, that are, like, really, really special, very, very expensive fabric that mm-hmm. has very particular patterning.
Right.
Where every valley would have its own
provincial dress, yeah.
Provincial dress,
yeah.
like
yeah.
its own dirndl, because every valley had a specific fabric and the color of the fabric,
mm-hmm.
and then
a
specific way how the dirndl is mm-hmm. designed. And probably it's in Panama. I don't know how regional Panama is.
We have the Waimea and then the Kuna. So some are from the mainland and then some are from the island. So their outfits are different. But mm-hmm. yeah, I mean, it happens in all types of countries. Like the region is very
right.
telling to the materials and the way things are woven.
In Scotland, they have kilts,
mm-hmm.
and every clan has different kilts.
Mm-hmm.
And they have like a summer kilt and they have a winter kilt. And they're not even the same colors
mm-hmm.
necessarily. But people who know those, they can look just like you probably can tell when you're in Austria. If somebody's in a dirndl, you know where they're from
yeah.
because that dirndl is from there.
Yeah. But it's also like building this community, you know, it's kind of like this, you know, how they dress up also when they did dances or when they, even the music, your band, you know,
mm-hmm.
has your own costumes.
That's right.
When they do like the band march thing, you know, in Austria, it's kind of like you
funny.
Can see all the different groups, and I think you're on to something with, you know, thinking about, you know, fiber and community, and also I feel a lot about identity as well.
Yes.
And I think that gets lost a little bit with the you know, this way of now how we dress now.
It's mass production.
Like the mass production, everything is made in China.
And it's very individualized
all over,
and purposeful,
you know,
and thinking about, like you said, you wanting the desire to be unique and make something feel special.
Right.
And I just, last question before Maria asks her last question. In your own practice, do you feel that there's something else you might want to experiment? Because, like, you blew me away with the whole clay wheel and making pottery, and we know you do weaving, yarn, fiber, sewing, clothes. Is there something else you've been potentially interested in dabbling in, but have not yet? Or you think you've got your arsenal?
Oh, no, there's always more. There's always more. I think I want to learn how to spin. I don't know. Ooh. I tried it once on a wheel. Just somebody came to my studio with a wheel and tried to show me how to do it, and I was not successful. But I love to see the indigenous people in South America with spindles, and the Native Americans, the Navajos, they have the really long spindle ones, and they roll it off the side of their leg, and I just think that's so cool. So I want to at least try that. And the other thing that I really, really want to do before I die is I want to make paper. I think that would be a really fun thing to do. Because paper is fiber also, and you can use
up
leftover pieces of yarn and scraps of fabric.
Yes, and so good till it's very pulp-like.
Mm-hmm. Right, and
we had this incredible workshop at the PAM where I learned how to make paper. And it was actually an artist from the States who was working with refugees in Berlin, but also here with veterans, and we were using like old uniforms and made paper out of them.
Wow.
Like we would make paper out of like what the Marines were wearing, or what the
cotton and stuff,
like the different colors also. Like, it was really, really interesting. Yeah, it was a great project. Okay, my very last question.
Okay,
you've been sitting in the magical rocking chair.
I love this rocking chair.
And it grants you three wishes. You can wish for anything and everything, but you have to say it out loud for it to come true.
Oh, dear.
These are the rules of the rocking chair. What are your three wishes? You can wish for anything, really.
Okay, so, well, my three wishes are that our whole political system just gets wiped off the map and we have a positive one that supports humanity and the environment. That's a really big one, but that's number one. Mm-hmm. Number two is that I wish prosperity for everyone that I know. Mm-hmm. And if prosperity comes to us through our art, all the better, because that's our passion.
Mm-hmm. True.
And number three, this is going to be tough. Number three, I wish you two all the best success with your rocking chair sessions.
Aww. Thank you. We're honestly grateful because it's because of people like you sitting down and taking your time from your schedule, driving from wherever to share your stories that have made this project so rich and just so informative and beautiful. So
we thank you
for coming to sit down with us
today. Oh, you're mostly welcome. And
thank
it
you
was
so
really
much.
Fun. I enjoyed it so much.
It goes too fast. I told Maria.
All righty, guys. Okay. Thanks so much for listening in again. And we're going to be back next week with a new session of On the Rocking Chair.
Yeah.
Woohoo.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.